Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello and good evening. Thank you for being here. I am Teresa Squatrito. I am an associate professor here at the LSE in the Department of International Relations. Our aim here this evening is to shed light on the role of law and courts in solving contemporary global and regional problems. I will be acting as the chair and the moderator of this event, and it is hosted on behalf of the Department of International Relations and the Grantham Research Institute here at the LSE. So welcome. So before beginning, there's just a couple of housekeeping things I need to mention. The first is that in the case of an emergency, the fire assembly point is outside the building, across the street, in front of Lincoln and Fields. Also, the event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available at a later date online. And I would ask that you please check that your phones are on silent. So without further ado, I'd like to give a little bit of a premise for our topic this evening, and then I will introduce our panel before jumping into a set of questions for us. So basically, there is no shortage of global problems. Any regular consumer of the news will probably be able to readily think of any number of problems. These are problems that are not purely national or local, but are actually problems that affect communities near and far, and mostly because of our interconnectedness. So some of these challenges that we might think of would include climate change, violence, but they might also include things like migration, health pandemics, development, fair trade and competition, and the list could go on. How are we to address these problems as a global community, which often trigger deeply held beliefs and evoke intense feelings? So respectful dialogue, I think, is a part of having these conversations, and I hope that is something we can practice this evening as we listen, learn, and ask questions. What I do know as a person who studies law and politics is that we can see that law and courts, both domestic and international, are often called upon to address some of these global and regional problems. And I want to give you three brief examples. So the first is, days after Russian forces invaded the Ukraine in February of 2022, world leaders and policy analysts alike were very quick to invoke international law. And then an unprecedented 39 states actually referred Russia to the International Criminal Court. We have similarly seen South Africa file suit against Israel before the International Court of Justice. And not long ago, when the ICJ sat to hear arguments from both South Africa and Israel, protesters assembled outside the Peace Palace in The Hague, which is the seat of the International Court of Justice. As a second example, I can speak of a little known court that sits in Hamburg, Germany, which is called the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea. And less than a month ago, this court declared that the Paris Agreement obliges states to cut carbon emissions that threaten our marine environment. Third, in the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic, across the globe, we have seen a whole host of lawsuits being brought before national courts challenging governments for the measures that they took during lockdowns. So it is in each of these instances that we see law and courts being mobilized in efforts to find solutions and remedies to what we can call global and regional problems. And so this is what I would like to refer to for our purposes this evening as lawfare. So It is against this backdrop, and to better understand the phenomenon of lawfare, that we have an excellent panel of experts here to speak to us today, and I'd like to introduce them. So first we have Professor Gary Simpson. He is a professor of international law here at the law school at LSE, and he is also a fellow of the British Academy. His latest work is entitled The Sentimental Life of International Law, Literature, Language, and Longing in Global Politics. Then we have, I'm going in the order in which they're going to speak. We have Sir Howard Morrison. He is a distinguished lawyer and jurist. He has served as a judge on the International Criminal Court and at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, and he is currently acting as the UK advisor on war crimes to the Ukrainian Prosecutor General. Then we have Dr. Ian Higham, who is a postdoctoral research fellow in environmental politics at the Grantham Research Institute. And then we are honored to have with us Professor Larry Kramer, who is the president and vice chancellor of the LSE since April of 2024, this year. He is a constitutional scholar and former, a university administrator, as well as a philanthropic leader and the former dean of the Stanford Law School. So, it was with that introduction I'd like to actually get to the meat of our conversation. And I'd like to start with Professor Simpson here. And I think maybe what some of you are wondering is, okay, big global problems like climate change or mass atrocities, for many of us, it may not seem obvious to resort to law and think of courts as part of that solution. So for you, I'm wondering, in your view, what does it mean to frame such global challenges in terms of law? What do we gain or lose from resorting to litigation or even invoking law?
Well, thanks, Teresa. A nice introduction to the seminar. And I guess that's the question. It does seem strange to lots of people, and maybe it is strange to use law in this way. So, as I was thinking about this seminar, my mind went back to Hannah Arendt's famous book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, with that even more famous subtitle, The Banality of Evil. And she goes to Jerusalem to observe the Eichmann trial, you know, full of hope, sort of radiant hope for a proper reckoning with the Holocaust, you know, one of the great moral events of the 20th century. And she thinks this court, the Jerusalem District Court, you know, sort of ordinary court in some ways, will provide this reckoning, will somehow explain what's happened. But after, you know, after observing the proceedings for The New Yorker, which, you know, led to the famous book, she described them as worthless, you know, hugely disappointing, disorienting. So she undertook a sort of journey, and I see elements of that in the present circumstance. So I think there are sort of, there's a dual experience that we're all having at the moment. One is there's this tremendous enthusiasm for sort of international law. You know, people talk about international law and talk in an international legal language a great deal. People are asking me all sorts of questions they never asked me before, this year in particular. So we've adopted a kind of international legal language to talk about global politics. In other words, it's extremely powerful. It often presents itself as so weak and virtuous, but in fact it's a very powerful language. On the other hand, the deployment of the language is often followed by a sort of disappointment that doesn't quite come off. So that's a pattern I've observed, you know, throughout my career. Now, this year in particular, we've seen a sort of judicialization of international law, a lot of stuff about courts. So now I get asked questions like, you know, well, what are provisional measures?
Right.
And what does erga omnes mean?
Right.
You know, questions that you wouldn't think that people around a dinner party would be that interested in, you know, technical questions about law. And about court-based politics. So I think, just to elaborate a bit, this goes to the question of a sort of faith in courts. And I would say one very important thing about this, that this faith in court-based resolutions to global politics is such a new thing. I mean, it only goes back 100 years. I count that as new in the history of international law. And I often think of a moment in 1914 after the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, when there's a lot of pressure on the Serbian state at that point, and the Austro-Hungarians issued an ultimatum. And the Serbians came back and said, listen, we don't have to go to war over this. We could go to the Permanent Court of Arbitration and settle our differences. And I think that's the model that, a lot of international lawyers, especially sort of legal utopians, have taken as their model. Why go to war when we could go to court? And so this has been the sort of move, this has been one of the major transformations in the 20th century. The way that war talk has become a form of law talk, and the way in which that law talk itself has been, you know, increasingly judicialized. And part of that, and you asked me about the downside and upside, I mean, part of that is a sort of individualization of responsibility in global politics. And you see that in particular in international criminal courts, because, and I'll just finish here, what international criminal courts do in a sense is that they take an individual or a set of individuals and they sort of extract that person from the context of a very complex context of war and peace and say, this is the man, and it invariably is a man in this case, this is the man who's responsible for these particular not just wrongdoings, but sort of structural injustices in the international system. So obvious downsides and upsides, which we can sort of go into in the Q&A.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, I think one of the big shifts, broadly speaking, in international law has been the shift away from thinking about states as the subject to individuals as the subject of law. And this is probably most obvious in the area of international criminal law, although I think we could find some other areas, arguably. At the same time, courts are often, we think of them as being reactive institutions and not always being able to have the proactive capacity that we often think is necessary for addressing problems. But there is one area where I think we have a lot of kind of evidence from the past that helps us to understand the extent to which they can be proactive, or if they're only kind of reactive institutions. And that would actually be also in the area of international criminal law. And so for Sir Morrison, my question is really about what can we learn about the capacity of courts to play this kind of proactive role based on past experiences. So the past experiences provide us with useful insights for whether or not law and courts are actually effective tools for addressing global problems. So what lessons do you think we have learned from earlier efforts to address conflict and atrocities, such as what we saw in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, through law and courts? Are courts, international courts, domestic courts, actually instruments for peace, or are they merely reactive institutions that are instruments for just providing justice in the aftermath?
Well, peace will be a dividend. The objective of international courts, ever since Nuremberg, Tokyo, the ICTY, the ICTR, the International Criminal Court, what is focused upon is individual criminal responsibility. And a lot of people still, including journalists who should know better, confound the ICJ with the ICC and think that a state can be prosecuted at the ICC. It can't be. It's individual criminal responsibility, and largely command and superior responsibility, because you're aiming for the top, which is why you have indictments against, for instance, Putin, Netanyahu. You don't have indictments against corporals and sergeants in the army. And, of course, the ICC is based upon complementarity. If a domestic court is dealing with it properly, then the ICC not only can't deal with it, it actually doesn't have jurisdiction under the Rome Statute. So if you have a trial of somebody, say, I was a trial judge in the case of Radovan Karadzic, did it help peace? I don't know, because The trouble is that most courts come into operation after the fighting is over. The big exception, of course, is Ukraine at the moment, where there are investigations and trials going on while the fighting is still going on. And I'm training judges who are trying cases within the sound of artillery fire. And it's hard work. But they are hoping that there is a deterrent effect. And is there a deterrent effect? Well, deterrence is one of the most difficult things to show in either domestic or international law. How do you show that something hasn't happened because of the existence of a court or a law? That's a hard process. Mm-hmm. I can give a couple of examples of where it may be leading. This is all a matter of record, so I'm not giving anything away. I was on the appeals chamber at the ICC when we allowed the investigation into Afghanistan, and the reaction of the Trump administration was extraordinarily hostile, including sanctions against the prosecutor and one of her staff. And yet it wasn't simply that the court was going to investigate American troops, they were going to investigate everybody involved in the conflict, Taliban, the British, anybody else. Mm-hmm. But the very fact that you've got that strong reaction suggests a form of psychological deterrence, at least. And again, we've seen it very recently in the case of the indictments against Putin and Netanyahu. Virtually no outrage about the indictments against Putin, except in Russia. But the indictments against Netanyahu, a lot of outrage in Israel, in the States. And so that suggests to me that when you get that sort of reaction, you must be doing something right. There is a form of deterrence there, that people are worried about the consequences of being indicted, let alone being convicted and sentenced. Students ask me all the time, is there any politics in international law? I mean, is there any alcohol in whiskey? Really, I mean, the important thing is this, and I defended at the ICTY war crimes and crimes against humanity. I defended an alleged genocidaire, at the Rwanda tribunal, and then I tried Radovan Karadzic for genocide. So I'm probably in a horribly unique position of being the only person in the world who's actually defended a genocidaire and tried one. The interesting thing is that you then see the enormity of what you're doing. I mean, the Rwanda genocide, 800,000 people killed in 3 months, mainly with machetes at roadblocks. It was about as disgusting an episode in humanity's history as you can imagine, beyond the Second World War. And so there is a deterrent effect even there now, because people remember it, and people remember it with shame. And if it's not a deterrent effect against the individual, it's a deterrent effect against society in some ways.
Right.
So, I mean, it depends on your viewpoint and the way you look at it. And while I'm at it, I'm just going to say the problem with the ICC, there are many problems with the ICC, but one of the biggest problems was it wasn't set up by the United Nations. It's a treaty-based court. If it had been set up by the United Nations, we'd have had Chapter 7 powers. But the ICC relies upon mature state responsibility.
Right.
And guess what? You don't get it in every case. You don't even get it from some countries who are signatories to the Rome Statute, let alone other countries.
Yeah.
So there are. I mean, when I was at the ICTY, we demanded cooperation from Russia, who were not very happy with the case against Serbia anyway, or Serbians. But they did it because under Chapter 7 they had to. It's an amazingly powerful tool.
Right. Yeah, definitely. State cooperation is essential for the ICC.
Yeah.
And in some ways, in most aspects of making law and international courts, as well as national courts, matter, right? Because, as you know, the famous adage goes, courts don't have the power of the sword, they don't have the power of the purse. All they have is the power of the word, right?
Yeah.
Or the argument. And so this is very striking in the context of some of these.
Just one other little thing.
Yeah.
Politics has got to stop at the court door. You can't stop the politics in international law before a case comes to court because it's normally predicated on some form of political action or military action which is aligned to politics. But what you can't do is allow the politics to come through the court door. And if the judges can't stop that, they should be seeking alternative employment, frankly.
Great. Thanks. So now shifting gears a little to questions around another big kind of challenge that the globe faces, and that is that of climate change. So for Dr. Haim, I wanted to ask or point out first that litigants, we can see, have put a lot of hope, as we see through many recent examples, in the capacity of international courts to drive social change. Some of these courts that have recently received cases related to climate change include the European Court of Human Rights, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, the International Court of Justice, the court I mentioned earlier, the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea. Others, in many instances, have turned to national courts to hold both governments accountable, but as well also private companies, right? So I see, in fact, this week, the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be looking at a case that has come up through the Hawaiian judicial system that addresses the issues about holding companies liable in regards to climate. So how, in fact, can courts be an instrument for solving the massive challenge that climate change presents, in your view? Can they deliver climate justice or act as catalysts for change? Or are there important limitations to the power that they have?
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So at the Grantham Research Institute, we have a lot of research on climate litigation, and it's something that's really kind of exploded, particularly in the past decade. So the Sabin Center at Columbia University, which our institution partners with, tracks these cases and has, I think, now counted about 2,666, I think is the latest. The vast majority of those are since the adoption of the Paris Agreement in 2015, and the vast majority of those are against governments. But as you say, they are also against corporations, often under tort laws of civil claims. The cases against governments have been significantly more successful. They have a pretty high success rate. They are more climate aligned. They are producing results that are, at least in principle, better for the climate, for reducing emissions or for promoting adaptation or rewarding loss and damage. And against corporations, it's more of a mixed picture. There haven't been so many major successful cases. The kind of famous one is Milieu Défensif versus Shell in the Netherlands, where the Dutch courts ruled that under Dutch law, Shell has a duty of care that includes essentially lowering its emissions in order to protect human rights. So, you know, it's a bit of a mixed bag. And as you said, there are these advisory opinions and this effort to go through international courts, and that's partly because there is no International Environmental Court. And so those advisory opinions and some of these major rulings against the framework laws of governments, against the overall climate picture, are really sort of adding to what we might call the legal stock. They are providing tools for future litigation. They're providing standards that and increasing legal norms around climate change that might be useful in holding these actors to account in future litigation. That said, of course, there are risks, there are shortcomings, there are limitations to climate litigation. I think a big one, I would say, is the time lag, right? So if we get these great international court advisory opinions, like the one from the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea that came last month, which held that that CO2 emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, are a form of marine pollution, and so states do have to reduce them. You know, now there can be lawsuits in national courts where that is invoked as some kind of standard, maybe not a precedent, but those court cases take a long time.
Yeah.
And then if the government still doesn't comply, you go back to court and it still takes a long time. And so we see that even in April, the European Court for Human Rights, as you said, ruled that Switzerland has this responsibility to protect human rights by taking bolder climate action. And yet the Swiss legislature this week has essentially shut that down. They've said, no, we're not going to do what we need to do to comply with this ruling. So in order for courts to have an effect on climate change, I think we can't see them as the solution. It becomes very piecemeal when we do that. They need to be seen, as the political scientist on the panel, I will defend the politics in and beyond the courtroom, they need to be seen as part of a broader movement. And sometimes we see that with legal strategies, for example, going after investment financial institutions that are trying to essentially force them to divest from fossil fuels or to stop financing exploration and extraction of fossil fuels. And then, of course, the bigger sort of legal mobilization of using these court cases to promote causes. So once you get a trial going, you can leverage that to be in the media. You can talk about your cause more, regardless of the outcome, but as part of the process towards the outcome, that can have ramifications beyond the single legal decision.
Right. Yeah, so a lot of times if we look more closely at some of this litigation, we can see they are attached to broader kinds of social activism or forms of mobilization to try and drive social change. And I think, broadly speaking, so my original kind of exploration into the role of law and courts and what I call legal mobilization was looking at the U.S. example and how a lot of movement or change with regards to rights occurred through the use of law and courts, but in combination with other kinds of social action, if you will. So, and I think that still remains quite prominent today, and we can see also, as you hinted at, but more broadly, that domestic law and courts can play a role in addressing many of these problems that previously, we didn't think domestic law and courts had much to deal with because these are transnational problems, right? Like, there was this kind of tendency to kind of separate and think of these as two spheres, and they didn't really mingle much. But increasingly, I think it's become more obvious that domestic courts actually have a role to play in addressing transnational problems. So I mentioned the COVID pandemic kind of litigation that all of that litigation spurs from a transnational problem, this pandemic. But we also see this in the case of climate. And so for Professor Kramer, who you know probably best among any of us here, the role of domestic courts and constitutional order. So this can, of course, extend to climate policy, but it might also address many other things like national health systems, as well as production of technologies that have an impact on the global environment. But for you, do you think, or let me ask, what would you think it would take for national courts to play a constructive role in addressing these sorts of problems that we see that often require actually coordinated international response and not solely a national-based one?
So in terms of domestic courts, the thing that I think you need to think about to start is what the limits are of courts, period, just
right.
Across the board. So I think implicit in a lot of the answers you've heard is courts can never get too far out ahead of the political system, including in the United States. There is no gains that were made by social movements that were started by courts. They
right.
were either ahead in the social movement and the court was bringing up the rear, or the court can play an important role on the kind of retail level. So once the wholesale changes have been made through some kind of political consensus, legislation, just some kind of normal democratic process that people have embraced, courts can then play a role. So that's as true for whether it's climate change, whether we refunded all that climate litigation, whether it's climate change, civil, whatever the issue is, the role of courts is going to be in that form. Now, it gets doubly difficult when you start talking about international, multinational, or transnational problems for two reasons. So one, if it's the enforcement of international law, a domestic court is bound to give precedence to its national law unless the national law explicitly authorizes it to give precedence to the international, and usually it doesn't. So it's one of the reasons why international courts are so important and have emerged over the course of our lifetime. So you're going to get into real limits there. And then second, as often as not, courts are going to make the problem worse rather than better. So particularly when you get into the complex multinational problems, which require some kind of transnational diplomatic solution to be worked out across many parties, many different stakeholders, particularly domestic judges are really not actually the people who you're going to want to be making strong decisions that reset where the politics is. They're not going to force anything that's not going to happen otherwise, but they can really muck up the works and make it much more difficult to reach some kind of solution. Not always. Sometimes by getting out ahead, they can force a political accommodation that might otherwise happen. But for the most part, I think what experience suggests is they're more likely to make things worse rather than better.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I just want to ask our panelists a common question on that basis, and then I'll open it up for a Q&A. And I think the common question I want to ask is actually the question of that was posed as kind of the title for this roundtable, and that is, do law and courts have power to solve global problems? So I'll just have that, we just go down the row.
Well, I think the answer is, I sort of gave an answer in my opening remarks that the situation is quite equivocal. I mean, it's likely to depend on the particular historical circumstances, but there's no doubt we should have sort of modest ambitions when it comes to courts. And I take the point that quite often and rather surprisingly they can do damage. So a huge amount of faith is being invested in the ICJ and the ICC at the moment, but let's not forget, for those who are investing that faith, that the ICJ could find against them, or the ICC could declare somebody innocent who we previously thought was guilty. So courts are sort of unpredictable, and that's one of their virtues. And then the other problem, of course, is that the international global order is a highly politicized one, in which sometimes diplomatic solutions are bound to be preferable to court-based reasoning.
I think my answer will follow from what I said before, which is, I think framing it in terms of power to solve global problems is not right. It's, do they have the ability to contribute to the solution of global problems? And the answer is yes, but they need to be quite careful and fairly restrained in how they do it. As I say, if you can work out political solutions through other means, I think courts then become an essential tool for implementing.
I mean, as I said earlier, I think courts and litigation, they're embedded in politics, right? They are part of the legal mobilization of social movements, and they are an important part of that, and those movements and that politics can solve problems. But courts also, they contribute norms and standards that eventually help us to solve global problems. So, I mean, the current climate litigation, a lot of it is rooted in what we would call the business and human rights movement, a lot of which is actually rooted in the Nuremberg trials against IG Farben for producing Cyclone B, against, I believe, Volkswagen and other German, more the industrialists than the companies themselves. But so these are norms that evolve over a long period of time and find new ways to hold new actors accountable on new issues with similar principles. And I think that in that sense, they may contribute to solving global problems, but there is no one court case absent basically a much more radically democratic global governance that is going to be able to solve global problems.
Yeah.
I'd agree with all of that, but when you look at domestic courts and the population in general, people don't realize just how much they are governed by international law as they are by domestic law. For instance, if your country is a signatory to the Geneva Conventions, or the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and you look at Article 27 of the Vienna Convention on Treaties, what that says is that you can't use domestic law to escape from your treaty obligations. So if you've signed a treaty, you're obliged to follow it. So domestic judges are, in fact, under the thrall of the treaty obligations that their governments have entered into in the past, the present, and in the future. So there's an enormous global persuasive power in the application of international treaties if they're honoured. And when they're dishonoured, like, for instance, the Geneva Conventions are honoured mainly in the breach, and they come before the courts, that's when you realise how important they are to protect the people who hopefully will be protected by them. But it's a... I mean, when you buy an airline ticket, you're invoking the Warsaw Convention. You don't realise that. You're actually... You know, you're paying money to establish a right that you have, if something goes wrong, to sue your travel agent, if they're... Or, am I too out of date? There aren't travel agents anymore.
No, they don't release
No, you do it
much.
Online. But you see what I mean. You constantly interface with domestic law, but you actually constantly interface with international law too, mm-hmm. but you probably don't realise it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. So I think at this point I'd like to open it up to a Q&A. So we do also have an online audience, so I will leave some space to gather questions from the online audience, but I'd first like to gather some questions in our live audience. So I'll start over here. Maybe I'll gather four or five. Yes, in the front row.
Some commentators have talked about the judicialization of politics as a bad thing, that it essentially it hurts popular recognition of courts, and in fact degrades politics as an arena for problem solving. Do you think the same kind of problems apply to international courts, where because they are non-political solutions by definition, do they just not have the same kind of stickiness?
Thank you so much for the very insightful panel so far. My question is not necessarily just for international courts, but also domestic courts. There's a lot of increasing sentiment around the verdict that a court gives being taken as optional. So a recent example is obviously with the Rwanda bill in the UK. The Conservative Party obviously kind of dismissed what the Supreme Court went ahead with and just decided to go along with it anyway. We're seeing similar sentiment when it comes to the indictment of Netanyahu, where it's being considered illegitimate, et cetera, et cetera. How do you think we can approach this sentiment where the legislature, which is actually, it should have the power over the executive and judiciary does have that power, how would you approach the sentiment where it seems to be dismissed or overturned?
I also thought, does law have the power to prevent global solutions? So obviously we have a lot of perhaps outdated law and perhaps a lot of outdated courts that are perhaps doing the opposite to this. And then also perhaps obviously different areas are perhaps not so subject to the power of the law, perhaps aid and aid relief and medicine, perhaps bypass courts very often due to another law or another type of law.
Great, thanks. I'll gather, say, two more, and then I'll turn to our panel. So right here in the white shirt and in the back in the black.
Hi, I'm Leonia, current master's student. I have so many questions, but I'll just ask one. How do you see forces of deglobalization affecting the power and future of international law? Thank you.
Forces of globalization, okay.
Thank you. In response to the last question about do courts have the power to kind of resolve or contribute to solving global problems, it seems as though this kind of restraint or delicacy that you talk about, it only applies to Western states or Western proxy states. When it's others, it seems like it's very straightforward around where criminality lies or where the crime has been committed. So what happens when the global problem is imperialism or neo-colonialism? And what role does the court have in preserving colonialism and dismantling it? And I think we can see from what's happening around the world just how much international courts are kind of enabling imperialism to occur. So the conversation seems like it's a very equal conversation, but we all know that different players have different weight in the game. So it'll be good to kind of address that in inequality.
Great, thanks. And then I
think that's enough.
Yeah, I think we'll have our panelists respond and then I'll see where we are with the online audience.
Well, I mean, I'm tempted just to say, come and do my course at the LSE, because these are precisely the subjects we talk about. I'll take that first question, though, on judicialization. I guess what I'm trying to get across to my, my students here at the LSE is the idea that judicialization, to borrow from Judith Sklar, is a choice. I mean, it's more of a choice probably in the international realm than it is in the domestic realm, that legalism is a choice. It's a particular way of doing something. It's a particular way of trying to find a solution to a political problem. And secondly, it may not be the best way. And to go back to the second or third question, it can sometimes do damage, and it can particularly do damage in an order which is thought to be radically unequal, in which some states or leaders might be perceived as to have immunity, and which is regarded by some people as imperial.
Go ahead. Yeah, how about we hear from you?
Oh, okay. I'll take the question from the back mostly. I think, you know, so when I say that international courts or domestic courts even can contribute to solving problems, I do think that, well, when I said alone they cannot do that unless they're embedded in sort of a more democratic global governance, that was exactly what I meant, what I was thinking of. I mean, these international courts were designed, many of the international institutions that we have were designed after the Second World War to reflect the outcome of that war, which essentially reflects, you know, these global North powers that won the war. And so these institutions were never really meant to be fully representative of the global South and are not going to be. And so that doesn't mean, I think, that we need to discount them altogether, or that they don't have some utility. You know, people say things like international law isn't perfect, but it's all we have. So I think it's something to build on, but of course I don't think that it's capable of solving problems that it was never designed or to be able to solve.
I'm going to ask for a show of hands first, because it's something I'm really interested in. How many people think that the power of one country having a veto in the Security Council of the United Nations is past its sell-by date? Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, you see, that is one of the great generators of solutions as well as problems. Oh. My own view is, and because I'm a fully qualified grumpy old man now, I can say this, I think the Security Council should be amended so that every member of the Security Council at any one time, which would be more than the five permanent members, of course, you can have a power of veto, but it would have to be by a majority of all the members of the Security Council at any given moment. And I think that would be far fairer, far more democratic, and it would do away with this nonsense that we have at the moment, where you have some perfectly good resolutions and you know which countries are going to veto them before they're even put to the test. So, and that, frankly, affects the whole of the international and the domestic judicial system in a way. It's a trickle-down effect. The ICC, one of the ways a case can come before the ICC is a referral by the Security Council. It's only happened twice in the case of Kenya and Darfur. I don't think it'll ever happen again because it's too split now, the Security Council. But it's a reflection of the sort of impotence, not only of international politics, but also international law, if we allow this sort of veto or this sort of stoppage of what are good ideas, to put it bluntly. I mean, the biggest problem we've got is we've stopped being nice to each other on a global as well as a personal level. And you wouldn't set up the ICC now. It wouldn't happen. It was set up at a time when multinationalism, multiculturalism was at its peak back in 2000, 2003, at times like that. But now we've fallen from that internationalism and multinationalism and multiculturalism down into the what I think is the pit of nationalism and false ideas of sovereignty. And you wouldn't get sufficient votes now to set up the ICC if you were trying to do it from scratch now. Don't worry too much. If you look at history, you see there's a sort of sine curve of nationalism and internationalism that goes through history.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like everything else. We look at colonialism, imperialism, whatever you like to describe it, as being a relatively modern phenomenon. It's not.
Hmm.
It's been part of the history of the world since man first became societal. With the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, and every other empire that's been. And it rises and it falls.
Right.
We're not at the end of history. We're at some point along the road of history.
Right.
And let's hope we're not at the end of history.
Yeah, let's hope not, yeah.
So to me, all the questions in some sense we're asking, I think, the same thing, which is how do we understand what gives judicial authority authority?
Yeah.
And so that, how can they play the role? And of course, the first point is that it is in fact thoroughly political. So the court's authority doesn't come from law, it comes from the acceptance of whoever the relevant actors are of the court's statements as something that should be obeyed. In 1996, I was at a conference in Italy. It was the first time justices from different countries got together. And there were justices from the US, Germany, Italy, the EU, Russia meeting. And I moderated a panel on federalism. And the German justice talked about a case that they had decided about whether states or the national government should be funding, you know, free medical education for everybody who wanted it. And the American judge talked about a case they decided about whether states could regulate migratory birds. And then the Russian talked about trying to do what they should do about Chechnya and about the 2 million people who'd been exiled to Siberia and what was supposed to be done in terms of repatriating them. And you know, you got a very clear picture, like these were not the same problem, right? And we said to the Russians after, you know, this is the wrong place for you. You don't have anything to learn from the justices in the West, in these countries, because their authority is so well established. You know, if you're looking at anything from our history, it would be, you should be reading Abraham Lincoln, not John Marshall, right? Because you have to build your political authority to get somebody to accept. So, you know, the answer is whether courts can play a role in pushing back or even dismantling, whether it's, you know, colonialism, imperialism, climate problems, really depends on the kind of authority they've been able to build across many, many other cases and in all the other things they do. And, you know, that, as I say, doesn't happen quickly. And the best role they can play, because they're almost never going to have, the bigger the problem, the less likely they are to have that kind of authority. So the best role that they can play is finding ways to make statements of principle that don't necessarily order anybody to do anything so that they don't get shown to have actually no power at all. Right, and that, to the extent that courts have a role, it can be as an asserter of principle or a developer of principle. Again, as the problems get smaller or the political authority that has created the law that's being asked to be enforced gets stronger, then they can do more.
Yeah, great. So was there any kind of unique question in the online forum that you think we should?
Yeah, there's maybe a couple.
Do you want to try and condense?
So, first one is from Vascor online. Are all recent climate-related court cases leading to lower carbon emissions or just enriching the lawyers involved? And then second, which is kind of asked a couple of times, is from Hayer, who's an LSE alum from Palestine. What fundamentalism and effectiveness does law hold, as well as courts, if countries such as the US and Israel have veto rights and strong lobby to manipulate and control decisions?
And I think we've kind of had some variant of an answer to that question. Yeah. I think maybe let's pick up on the first question, if we may, which I think is basically a little bit of the question that is, law and courts is largely a very elitist sort of set of institutions and practices. So what does it have to do for the ordinary people, right? Or are these a set of practices and processes that are really just there to further enrich those who are well off? I'm sorry. Yes, I think you can go for that question.
I do not have great statistics on sort of where the money is going in these cases. Joanna, who couldn't be here, might have known more about that. But I mean, in some ways, I think these are actually very similar questions, although they're talking about very different topics, which is, you know, can justice be realized in a system where elite dominance and global capital flow in very particular directions? I'm quite critical. I would say that it's not the brightest picture, but there are some. I think that these climate wins are important, although they do they do of course exist within a system that of financial inequality and of and of power disparities.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is.
Does
anyone
else want to?
Yeah. So in some ways, the answer is all of the above, right? So it definitely enriches the lawyers. And it can simultaneously, if it changed the way the businesses work in ways that reduce emissions, although then that's going to just change where the money flows go. But you'd rather have that than nothing at all. The thing about the climate litigation, when we started it, so we, as I say, when I was in my prior job at Hewlett, we funded the initial climate litigation. It was with zero hope that those cases were actually going to win, and fear that they might actually in the lower courts, because if we did win in the lower courts and they went to the Supreme Court, they were going to undo the whole thing and just say nobody could bring these lawsuits at all. So a lot of it was working with the lawyers to figure out the thing that we thought we could do throughout that litigation, which was get to discovery and get evidence exposed. And also reframe the political debate, because the ones that we were funding were lawsuits by citizens against the oil companies, basically saying your funding or the work that you've done to produce climate change is being passed along to us in the form of taxes to clean up from the, you know, harms that are committed by it, and so you should have to pay. Now again, the chances of winning those lawsuits are really, really, really low, but it can be a powerful communications argument. So you think about litigation as having those kinds of options and opportunities as well.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.